for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients a solution for failed root canal-treated teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Last week, a rumor, started perhaps by the commissioner's office, had it that the desperate financial condition of the Tampa Bay Devil Rays had rendered the team late in making payments to two former Rays. In the visitor's dugout before a game Tuesday in Boston, current Devil Ray Andy Sheets did not exactly exude confidence in the solvency of his employer.
I think Tampa has enough money to pay us. Hopefully they do. I think they do. I think most teams, just about, I think all teams do. Like I said, I don't know what's true, what's fiction, but I don't know. Well, my check cashed. Hopefully it will. I think it will this next paycheck. And, I think we're all right.
Currently battling to escape the distinction of worst team in the major leagues, the Devil Rays were welcomed to Boston on Tuesday morning, at least by the headline writers of the Boston Globe sports section. Rays of Hope for Sox was their message, and Jason Conti, an outfielder in his first season with the lowly Rays, says he's heard even worse.
Well, I heard ESPN call us the Elixir the other day, so you could probably figure that out for yourself. But I think a lot of teams underestimate us a little bit. I think they underestimate our starting pitching, and I think sometimes they take us a little lightly, and we sneak up on some teams, but a lot of times we come up short.
The Rays came up a whopping 18 runs short in the first game of the Boston series this week, a 22-4 loss. The near-daily battering must be especially hard for Jason Conti to accept, given that his previous employer, whom he joined for 2 weeks last summer, was the world champion Arizona Diamondbacks. A cruel relocation, I ventured, but Conti, who's been in the big leagues less than a full season, was philosophical.
Well, there's not really too much I can do about it. A guy with half a year and doesn't have the luxury of having a no-trade clause, so it was what the Diamondbacks thought they needed to do at the time, and they traded a couple young guys for a couple veteran guys, and they ended up winning the World Series. So
they send you half a share or, half a thing?
I got a tiny bit of a monetary bonus or whatever, but I got a World Series ring, so that was very nice of them to give me that for a couple weeks of service last year, and, I thank them for it, and it's a really nice ring.
One might wonder how a guy with a World Series ring is supposed to get used to playing for Tampa Bay, a bad team that draws relatively few fans. But Jason Conti told me that before he turned pro, he played ball at the University of Pittsburgh. Ah, I said, one of those schools famous for its baseball program.
Oh, famous, yeah. We got about 10 to 20 people at the games, and most of them were my family.
Because of the possibility that a player's strike will prematurely end the season, and because some of the owners have suggested that if there is a strike, they'll shut down the game for a couple of years, if that's what it takes to reorganize the product to their specifications, a sense of humor is a crucial tool for any player this summer. Another necessary quality would seem to be a tendency toward thrift, and Jason Conti seems to have heard that message.
Well, that's what they tell us. I mean, the older guys have actually been telling us that for months now, is to, don't be stupid with your money. And especially this team, we have a lot of young guys that are just starting to build like a financial base. And they've said, save your money, save your money. And it's right up to the point now where, we're glad we did.
Glad we did should not necessarily be construed to mean that Jason Conti and his fellow Devil Rays expect this season to end prematurely in a strike. The truth is that most of the players in the major leagues, no matter how well their teams are faring, have no idea what, if anything, will develop from the ongoing alleged negotiations between baseball's management and its labor. And though you might think players for a team that's 30 games out of first place would have less of a stake in a full season than their colleagues on contenders, Tampa Bay second baseman Andy Sheets, who's played for five different teams over parts of seven seasons, says the gulf between players and fans is not always as wide as fans might expect.
Well, I mean, you don't want any kind of stoppage just for the good of the game. It's going to hurt everything. So, unfortunately, we're having a rough season, but you know, like I said, just for the good of the game, for overall everything in baseball, you don't want it to stop. So, you know, and even as a player, I mean, yeah, we're way back in standings, but we're still baseball fans too. You know, we enjoy good games and, you know, good seasons.
For the Devil Rays, two of the next three games were good enough to gain them a split in their series with the Red Sox. Unhappily for Tampa Bay, the Rays remain the least successful team in the bigs. Regarding the state of the game itself and the likelihood that Tampa Bay's miserable ride might end early in a general strike, nobody on the labor or management side claimed to know any more than they claimed to know last week, except that both sides have agreed to meet almost continuously next week. With the advantage of a month's perspective, do we conclude that the performance of the U.S. men's team at the 2002 World Cup was bad news for fans in Europe and Latin America who wish this country would stick to the games it already dominates? Can we assume that performance was very good news for Major League Soccer? Soccer analyst Seamus Mallon joins me now to end the speculation. Maybe. Hello, Seamus.
Hi, Bill.
The U.S. team reached the quarterfinals and some have said outplayed Germany as well in the loss that followed. Will the U.S. be respected and even feared henceforth in international play?
Certainly respected. I think the era now is past us where the United States team was considered to be an aberration, a joke, a bunch of cowboys playing a game that the rest of the world has mastered. There will be still some lingering jingoism that you will find in the worst of the British journalists, for instance, and also in the worst of the German journalists, but much less so now than after that fantastic performance against Germany. And keep in mind, the next World Cup is going to be hosted by Germany, so they'll be ready for the U.S. and the rest of the world will. It was a very, very impressive performance.
Quite recently, Landon Donovan, one of the stars of the U.S. team, said that he would continue to play in MLS rather than return to Germany. Did MLS heave a great sigh of relief at that news, or would the league rather sell some of its Donovan-like stars to the wealthy clubs in Europe?
Well, to be absolutely accurate, he said he would prefer to play in the United States because the truth of the matter is his contract is owned by Bayer Leverkusen.
He's on loan now.
He is on loan to his own country at the moment. Which is a perverse thing in these times of weird movements in finance. A loan to your own country to play seems quite odd. But it is very interesting. He may be a very special case. I think we may have to separate him out from the normal issue of should you go over, should you play here, because he is a poster boy now for the game in this country, no question, with David Letterman show and all that kind of stuff. He's very much a huge asset for soccer in this country. So the great thing about Landon Donovan is that on the field, he is also phenomenal. I mean, he's really got it. He is the best American player, I think, that this country has ever produced. And it would be great to see him play here. Now, why he wants to stay, though, is a little subtly different from what we're used to hear in the past. John Harkes, for instance, went to England, blazed a trail there, did very well. But John had the personality, I think, to adopt to the rough and tumble of the European game, the British game. I'm not sure, frankly, that Landon Donovan has what it takes in terms of resilience, mental resilience, to put up with what you have to put up with in the professional arena over there.
I know that you have been impressed by how well some of the national team players have performed since returning to their MLS teams. We've talked about that. In year seven, can we say the quality of play in the league in general has continued to improve?
I think it has, and I think that was evident even before the World Cup came upon us. In fact, you might argue that there was a little bit of a drop when all the players went off to the World Cup. And they went off to prepare first. It wasn't just going to Korea,
right.
Japan. They had to go to weeks of training. So there was a bit of a drop-off there. There were some games in that period that weren't so great. The interesting thing to me, Bill, is going to be see what happens come playoff time. Because at that point, surely the toll taken on players will be really quite visible, and particularly for those players who made that super effort in playing five World Cup matches. We've not had that kind of thing to worry about in the MLS season in the past, but it could very well be key when it comes down to September and October.
One feature of the Eastern Division of MLS this year has been parity. The first-place team has won two more games than the last-place team. Is this an indication of great competitive balance or conference-wide mediocrity?
Well, I'm afraid it's more the latter than the former. The Eastern Division is not very good at the moment, in large part, I think, because of the best franchise there is Chicago, and they have just been hit by so many injuries and lost players to the World Cup that they've really not had a chance to get the level of their game up to the standard that they've set in the past, which has really been a tremendous standard. The DC United history is a very good history of championships won, but since the breakup of that team because of the salary cap, they've never really quite recovered from that, and the revolving door of coaches hasn't really helped. So I think you're right, and then to go on to analyze the Revolution would take a whole other show, frankly, because of their remarkable grasp on failure. So the Eastern Division this time around, of course, is very disappointing, and I would guess every single team in the Western Division will make the playoffs.
The most successful team in the league is, of course, from the Western Division. That would be San Jose, playing at Kansas City tonight. The Earthquakes will probably have 13 wins by about 11 p.m. Eastern time. Do we make San Jose the favorite for the championship at this point?
I think so, although I wouldn't be quite so sure about their result in Kansas City. They have not done well on the road. They've won a dozen games at home, I think, but if you look at their road record, it's something like 2-6-2. I mean, they struggle on the road, and they don't score goals on the road very, very often. So Kansas City is stung by some recent adversity. They, I think, will be doing everything they possibly can to make their point. Nonetheless, San Jose clearly has the formula. They have a coach whom the players love. He's got the formula right. They have an attractive style of play. They like to go forward, and they've got tremendous goalkeeping. So they have the formula to win it all, and I think they definitely are the odds-on favorite to win it, again, with hot pursuit from Dallas, I think.
Seamus Mallon broadcasts soccer for ESPN and talks about the game for Only a Game as well. Thank you, Seamus.
You're welcome, Mel.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. In the North Wales village of Landrillo, Prince Charles recently gave lawn bowling a go. Dressed in a suit and bent very slightly at the waist, frowning in concentration, the prince let fly a throw that scattered the photographers covering the extraordinary event. "I'm trying to get the feel of the ground," His Majesty explained lamely. "The trouble is, it's wet." Delwyn Lewis, the chairman of the local bowling club, was diplomatic in his response. "He would be welcome to join our team," Mr. Lewis said, "but he needs a bit more practice, as do I. I think he needs to bend his knee more." Leads one to wonder, does it not, if the knees of royals bend?
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. To hear Bill Littlefield's commentary about the threat of a Major League Baseball strike, log on to our website, WBUR.org, and click on News. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Yankee Magazine, the magazine of New England living, announcing a redesign including new home, food, garden, and travel features in the summer 2002 issue on the web at yankeemagazine.com. And by Peapod by Stop and Shop, online grocery shopping providing home and business delivery throughout Metro Boston and serving the Mid and Upper Cape through August on the web at peapod.com. In the forecast, mostly cloudy skies today, highs in the lower 70s, tonight slows in the mid-60s. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a slight chance of showers, highs in the upper 80s. Monday, warmer, highs in the mid-80s. It's 7:20.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, the week's sports news with Charlie Pierce. But first, it seems appropriate that the cover of Sex, Lies, and Headlocks, subtitled The Real Story of Vince McMahon and the World Wrestling Federation, should bear the cartoon-like image of McMahon's head on the bulging body of a gloating grappler. The TV cartoon world over which McMahon has presided for years is chronicled in this new book by Sean Assale and Mike Mooneyham. Sean Assale joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Sean, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. Glad to be here.
Nobody who's ever watched pro wrestling on TV should be surprised that it's scripted, but the details of some of the scripts may surprise folks, and I like the fact that some of the champions have had clauses in their contracts giving them final say over who could take away their titles. I gather sometimes that has caused some considerable friction.
Oh, absolutely. During the heyday of Ted Turner's WCW in the late 90s, Hulk Hogan really inspired the wrath of a lot of wrestlers because he had essentially script approval over his own matches, and everything that he did wound up being culminated in these pay-per-views where the wrestlers made the most money. I mean, you know, this whole thing is just, you want to understand wrestling, follow the money, and the money culminates in these huge pay-per-views, and every script and every plot line seemed to culminate with Hulk Hogan getting a quote-unquote blow-off, getting a payday at the pay-per-views. And so that's the sign of power, who gets script approval. And sure, there are a lot of boys or wrestlers in the locker room who are, you know, running around furious about that. It's no different than any soap opera set or any, you know, Hollywood film set. And there's a lot of pride in this. I mean, these guys take pride in their world of make-believe. Sometimes they tend to believe their make-believe world a little too much, and that leads to problems, but they do take a lot of pride in what they do.
Even in the context of pro wrestling, there is excess, and then there is excess. Ted Turner, for example, was all for women beating the wrestlers over the head with sticks, but he didn't much like one wrestler pulling a plastic bag over his opponent's head.
Well, I write in the book that a Turner executive could expect a reprimand in his file if he let the word damn go out over the airwave. So imagine Ted's consternation when one wrestler tried to asphyxiate another with a plastic bag on live TV. The executive who was in charge at the time got called up to Ted Turner's 14th floor office in the CNN Tower, and he was met with the words, "Gosh darn it, we will not have people asphyxiating themselves with plastic bags on this network. There are kids watching."
So it was okay to have the women beating the guys over the head with sticks while kids watched, but not the plastic bag thing.
In wrestling, you learn quickly, everything is relative.
At one point, one of TV wrestling's promoters, another Turner Broadcasting guy named Jim Hurd, suggested that it would be a great idea to hire two hunchbacked wrestlers for a tag team since they could never be pinned. In researching this book, did you come up with any more grotesque suggestion?
I'm not sure that that was the most grotesque suggestion, maybe the most naive. I think what the most grotesque suggestions, I think, came out of the WWF in the mid to late 90s when Vince really had his back up against the wall. And, you know, I write in the book that since the earliest days, he's been a fighter, since he's sort of tried to claw into the wrestling world by worming his way into his dad's company. And I write a lot about his youth and about his father and about how his dad sort of kept him on the outside because he never quite trusted Vince. So Vince has always been a fighter. And in the mid-90s, when both Turner and the government were attacking Vince, I think a lot of the most grotesque things he did were designed to sort of create a new genre of wrestling shock TV. And that's when you started to see crucifixions. That's when you started to see wrestlers beating one another into caskets. And perhaps, I think my all-time favorite, you saw an 82-year-old woman in a Madison Square Garden match rip off her shirt and appear topless. And there's some debate as to whether she was actually topless or it was a prosthetic, but you'll forgive me if, you know, the fine points of the debate don't interest me.
Well, McMahon's own life has sometimes seemed as lurid as the scripts of the bouts that he promotes. You report that he used steroids and cocaine himself, and that at one point he was making arrangements that would have enabled him to run the whole empire from jail, should that be necessary.
Vince absolutely believed he was going to jail. And this is in 1994, when his company had just come through a very, very lucrative period. And as I write in the book, there were really no boundaries. It was a small company. Bosses were sleeping with their secretaries. Frankly, everybody was sleeping with everybody. And there was so much money going around that it was a rolling party. And ultimately, you know, Vince sowed the seeds of that by having the government investigate him for what at the time they believed was running a steroid distribution ring. And this was just shortly after steroids had become criminalized under a sweeping omnibus drug act passed by Congress. So Vince gets indicted and brought into a federal court and believes that the power of the government will do what nobody else can, which is shut him down and force him to essentially run the company like a mob boss from prison. So he interviews people to set up lines of communication. And one of the most startling scenes in the book, he believes that the government can actually eavesdrop on him through the glass windows of his office with directional mics. So he shoos people away from the window into the middle of his office and he whispers. Vince truly believed he was going to jail. He was ultimately acquitted, I think rightly. I thought the government brought a weak case. But at the time, he didn't know that. He didn't know that until the jury said the words, not guilty.
One character with whom I was not familiar before I read the book was Brian Pillman. The arc of his career demonstrates that although the wrestling is fake, the damage done to the wrestlers both inside and outside the ring is altogether too real and hideous.
Absolutely. I mean, Brian Pillman was a terrific athlete. He was also born with all sorts of congenital birth defects that made him really, especially in his throat, have to suffer through any number of operations before he was 10. Instead of babying his body, he went the other route. In the streets of Cincinnati, he believed that since he had already gone through so much, he could beat up anybody who came his way. And he didn't. He developed his reputation as a street fighter. That led him to a brief football career, but he was ultimately too small to really make it. He got to the Cincinnati Bengals, but didn't go far. And after he was cut, it was really a short hop from there to wrestling, where really nobody cared what he did to bulk up his body. And so he began this dependence on steroids. He ultimately got married to a woman who had a terrible drug dependency. They had a child together. He then separated from her, got remarried to a penthouse pet. There was terrible fights over the custody. And one day, the ex-wife is talking to the new wife, and they're arguing over custody. And the ex-wife kills herself there on the phone. Brian is haunted by this, haunted by the fact that his child's mother has been, you know, has shot herself, ups his dependence on steroids even more, ups his dependence on other pills. And it's a spiral until, you know, one day he's driving along in a Hummer, drives off the road, sails out the window, and nearly kills himself. Now, what's interesting about this is he wove this into his act. He became known as a man who was literally had a suicide fetish, and fans were rubbernecking, kind of wanting to see how far he would push it. And he used this to become, for a time, the hottest person in wrestling. Ultimately, when he died ugly and alone in a hotel. His heart gave out. He had bottles of pills beside him. It was not specifically linked to steroids, though I think anybody who knows him knows that it was a factor. What was perhaps the oddest thing about that whole episode, as I write in the book, is that Vince was confronted with what to do in the hours after his death, and he basically did what any news magazine show would do. He put the widow on the tube. Mm. And the appearance of Melanie Pillman on a WWF show 24 hours after her husband died, many thought it was Vince's most singularly exploitative moment.
Do you anticipate that the story you tell in Sex, Lies, and Headlocks will have any effect on the popularity of TV wrestling? Does it become more popular because you've told what you've told here?
My real goal in writing this book is almost to have it bought by parents so they can see what their kids are watching, so they can learn about what their kids are watching, and they can make their decisions. I don't like my child to watch wrestling. I have friends who I trust and I love who watch it with their kids. I was persuaded that during Vince's comeback years of 97, 98, and 99, what was happening was a lot of kids were going to their rooms and telling their parents they were watching wrestling. And parents vaguely remembered Hulk Hogan and Cyndi Lauper in the cartoon years and said, oh, yeah, that's fine. They didn't know what their kids were watching. And these were in the real shock TV years where kids were getting their first opinions of homosexuality through the things Vince was doing. They were forming their opinions of women through the things Vince was doing. And I wanted to write this book to, if nothing else, give parents whose kids watch this stuff some sense of what the industry was like, as well as to write a book about one of, I think, the seminal figures in television over the last 20 years.
Sean Assale is the co-author of Sex, Lies, and Headlocks, published by Crown Books. He joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Sean, thank you for speaking with me.
Oh, thank you, Bill.
This spring, the World Wrestling Federation, the WWF, became World Wrestling Entertainment, the WWE, when the World Wildlife Federation went to court and won its initials back. But it wasn't the change in name that altered the nature of the appeal of the beast, as Only a Game's Karen Given recently discovered.
Going to wrestling, and you already have your tickets in your hand.
Young children stream into the Fleet Center in Boston for a recent WWE SmackDown event, dragging their parents behind them. Many of these fans seem to be more savvy than pro wrestling buffs of old. Instead of insisting that every body slam and headlock is real, they talk of plot lines and script writers. Even fans like 8-year-old Anthony are beginning to catch on.
Why do you like it?
Because I like the entertainment.
Is it a sport, you think?
Yep. It's a sport entertainment, so, yeah.
More entertainment than sport or more sport than entertainment?
Entertainment.
When a company promises sports entertainment, the fans want just that. But some say, right now, they're not getting it. Inside the Fleet Center, 21-year-olds John, Peter, and Jamie cram down hamburgers and fries minutes before the night's entertainment begins. They've gone to every wrestling event in Massachusetts for the past half dozen years and have even traveled as far as California for special events. But John says today's wrestling product is hard to take, even for wrestling's most loyal fans.
It's really bad right now, if you compare it to 3, 2, 4 years ago.
Do you ever wonder, I mean, is it really not as good, or are you just getting older?
That's what I thought. Am I just getting older? Maybe that's why I'm not enjoying it. But they did something that I really liked. I'm like, no, it's just really bad right now.
The slump in the WWE's television ratings has everyone talking tonight. During the first 5.5 months of the year, WWE SmackDown lost 35% in its key demographic, teenage boys. Other WWE programs saw less dramatic declines, from 10 to 19%. It's a striking change from just 2 years ago, when the WWE SmackDown and Raw each reached 5 million homes a week. Raw was the top-rated show on cable, and two autobiographies by wrestlers topped the New York Times bestseller list. Today, even diehard fans like 15-year-old Paul are feeling the crunch. He bought extra tickets for tonight's show, hoping to bring some friends. But the only person he's been able to entice into coming to the event is his father. Still, Paul says he's not worried about the long-term future of wrestling.
To tell you the truth, I just think, in general, the country goes in fads, really, like, especially in music, and this is just as much of an example of pop culture as anything else.
Need tickets, guys? Need them?
No, thanks. It's just basically that, at one point, it was just so revolutionary with a guy by the name of Stone Cold Steve Austin, you know? He was doing what everybody else wants to do, you know, telling his boss what he thinks, drinking beer and eating hot dogs, you know, the typical American dream, I guess.
Well, bottom line is everything sucks.
In May, Austin called into a WWE webcast to air his opinions on the league.
I'm not happy with the direction Stone Cold Steve Austin is going. I ain't happy with the direction the whole company's going. I think the writing has been pretty substandard. I'll go on better now. It's been piss poor.
Days later, Austin didn't show up for a WWE Raw performance and was fired. Shortly after that, he was arrested for allegedly beating his wife. Dave Meltzer, writer and publisher of the Wrestling Observer, a weekly magazine devoted to professional wrestling, says Austin's departure had a huge impact on the league.
To wrestling fans, Steve Austin was the biggest star in the company. Even though most think it was The Rock, Steve Austin actually drew more people and drew more ratings than The Rock. And The Rock is in and out because The Rock has so many movie commitments. So, you know, they don't have that nucleus that carried them for all those years.
The WWE says it will take advantage of the dearth of big talent to promote new stars. And despite the drop in ratings, the WWE's director of public relations, Jason Bernstein, likes to point out that the league still has one of the highest-rated shows among teens on cable television.
People like to make more of it than it is, but our business has always been very up and down, and we ride the wave of our talent and our fans, and when we have great programming, our ratings go through the roof, and when our program may not be at its best, the fans walk away. So we're in a stage right now of rebuilding our programming and rebuilding our talent roster and rebuilding our storylines.
More important than the departures of the WWE's biggest stars, Dave Meltzer says the company has been quicker to give up on programming ideas after losing $47 million in 1 year on its failed football venture, the XFL.
Because of the failure of the XFL, they were afraid to fail at other things. And, you know, in Vince McMahon's track record, the truth is that many, maybe even most of the things he succeeded at are things that many people figured he would fail at, but he had the guts to do it. But then the XFL was such a spectacular failure that everyone ahead of time told him would be, that I think it affected his psyche, and he was afraid of another big failure, so, you know, he pulls the plug on things way too soon.
Instead of working on long-term plot lines, Meltzer and others say the WWE has focused on one-time gimmicks that boost the ratings for one program without developing any long-term interest.
Today at the World Times Square, New York City, Divas getting ready for the first ever New York City Thong-a-thon.
Oh, man! Check him out! They're arriving! Terry! Oh, Terry!
On a highly promoted recent show, female wrestlers abandoned the ring for the catwalk and pranced around in lingerie in a WWE-style beauty pageant. The fully scripted contest ended with a catfight over the trophy while an announcer sang the pageant's theme song.
There she is, Miss Golden Thong.
Those hoping to put the last nail in the WWE's coffin might have to wait a bit longer. Last week, the WWE put former WCW rival Eric Bischoff in charge of Raw and attracted a 13% jump in ratings from the week before. And Dave Meltzer says if McMahon gives this change a chance, it just might work. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Huh. You smell what the Rock is cooking. The Rock says... The Rock says... The Rock says...
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Good morning, I'm Dolores Handy. In sports headlines, the Baltimore Orioles beat the Boston Red Sox 9-2 last night. It was Boston's fourth loss in five games. The two teams play again this afternoon at Fenway Park. In Major League Soccer, the New England Revolution are on the road in Washington tonight against the D.C. United. The Boston Breakers are at home hosting Philadelphia this evening at Nickerson Field. Bob Gilder shot a 6-under par 66 yesterday to take a one-stroke lead in the opening round of the Senior PGA's Fleet Boston Classic in Concord. Two-time defending tournament champion Larry Nelson was among five players in second place with a 5-under par 67. Arnold Palmer had the shot of the day with the only eagle of opening day on the par 5 10th hole. And World Boxing Association heavyweight champion Johnny Ruiz, a Massachusetts native, defends his title against undefeated Kirk Johnson of Canada tonight in Las Vegas. Odds makers have Ruiz as the underdog. In the forecast, mostly cloudy today, highs in the 70s. Tonight, lows in the mid-60s. Tomorrow, partly sunny. Slight chance of rain, highs in the 70s. Many of the books you hear about on Only a Game are available through our website. Just go to onlyagame.org and click on Public Radio Store. And remember, part of every purchase helps pay for the news on WBUR. 64 degrees in Boston at 7:39.
Venice was once a center of trade, with spices, wine, and oil passing through the city on the way to the east or west. I'm Alex Chadwick. Venice has changed, but the spirit of those early days remains. I hope you'll join me this December on our next Citizens of the World tour. The proceeds help pay for the news.
For more information, call 800-909-9287.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a segment for lovers of GS4s, Silver Pigeons, and Twin Stars. But first, our analyst Charlie Pierce is here to discuss the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
What updates have you concerning Take Me Out to the Negotiating Room Week 17?
Well, the owner's side is coming out saying, we're close, we're close, we're close. The player's side is saying, well, we're not killing each other yet, so things are looking up. The same issues that have been the sticking points all along are still the sticking points. It is the contention of the ownership that they need a high luxury tax. It is the contention of the union that this is a de facto salary cap. The union is correct on this, of course. And they're also trying to figure out how they're going to work the revenue sharing plan. They want to switch from from a split pool plan, which gives more money to the teams with the lowest revenue and takes less away from teams with the highest, to a straight pool, which helps clubs in the middle more. This coincidentally would, by and large, help, among other teams, the Milwaukee Brewers,
which, as we know,
are not owned by the Commissioner of Baseball.
Is it a good sign that they've agreed to have a great many meetings over the next 2 weeks or so?
I think meeting while not throwing the dessert tray at each other is always good. So, yes, I think maintaining the public quasi-fiction that things are moving towards some sort of settlement is also good, at least for the game and the people who are still devoted to it.
Out of New Jersey this week came a story of Little League coaches urging their team to lose. Another unfortunate story for an organization that must really be getting used to them, I would suppose.
Everybody over the age of 12 should now be banned from Little League forever, because clearly adults can't get involved with this without screwing it up. In a town in New Jersey, one league's all-star team claims that it was asked to throw a game to the other all-star team from the same town so that, the latter team would have a better record going into tournament play.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any point to grown-ups in sports anymore?
Then, as if baseball wasn't getting enough bad publicity in this summer, the potential strike, a mobster named Michael Francisi has been saying that during the 70s, major league players who owed money to the mob fixed games. I wonder if Mr. Francisi is, as the saying goes, a credible witness.
Well, you find very few choir boys involved in these kind of charges. I think that this is not, it's not coming from the National Enquirer. This is coming from a credible source, which is HBO's Real Sports program, which has generally been, in the short time it's been on the air, become an enormously credible news organization. I don't know. The layers of this go deeper because, according to Mr. Francesi, these players were asked to throw games because they already owed money to the wrong people.
Right.
I expect that you will see Major League Baseball take absolutely no action on this for at least, 10, 15, 20 years.
Have you examined the oil-stained Ted Williams biostasis pact? And if so, what is your opinion? Binding document or oil-stained fraud?
Well, oil-stained fraud, whether it's binding legally or not, I have no idea whether something like this is binding legally. I mean, it's rather like saying I'm married because someone once wrote her phone number on a cocktail napkin at 2 o'clock in the morning. But for three, I do have to say that after 3 weeks of wondering what John Henry Williams' Trump card was, considering there's a legitimate will written on unmarked paper saying Ted Williams wants to be cremated, 3 weeks after that, John Henry Williams pulls what appears to be the Shroud of Turin out of the trunk of his car and claims that, oh, by the way, this is what Dad really wanted. It doesn't look altogether like a $3 bill, but metaphorically it fits perfectly.
On Wednesday, John Regas, the founder of the bankrupt Adelphia Communications Corporation and titular owner of the Buffalo Sabres as well, was indicted on conspiracy charges along with his two sons. Can't the National Hockey League find better investors?
Well, let's be fair. I mean, Mr. Regas was not let out in handcuffs on national television because the National Hockey League was sucker enough to get involved with him. This is some serious business. And, of course, last month the NHL took control of the Sabres in the hopes to sell the team to somebody less likely to be doing 5 to 15 at Allenwood. And apparently now, that given this development, who knows what the Sabres are actually worth at this point? Who knows what may have been looted from their finances? The NHL will likely be running the Sabres through next season.
With two more days left in the Tour de France, Charlie, overall leader and very probable winner Lance Armstrong is looking back and thumbing his nose at the French police, who, try as they may, have not been able to come up with evidence that Lance et al. Are doping. Is this whole matter as laughable as Lance has been maintaining that it is?
He is making a minky out of us. He's making a minky out of our police force.
Phil, down, you have a bimp. Make him in it.
He's hit no bimps in the Tour de France. Now, it's terrible because, I mean, every year we go through this, long about the second Monday of the thing, there's nothing left but the bitter recriminations because he's so far ahead of the race.
Absolutely.
There's nothing else to talk about. If Lance wants to shut this crisis off, he should not win by so much.
We've discussed the possibility that Charlotte, North Carolina, which just lost its NBA team to New Orleans, may have a replacement team very soon, and now three different groups are apparently competing for the opportunity to run a team there. Why is it that the city of Charlotte is so attractive to everybody except George Shinn and Ray Wooldridge?
Because they were thieves and mountebanks, that's why. Everybody knows that Charlotte will come out for this professional team if it's run properly, if it's run in such a way that noses are not being openly thumbed at the populace. The city council has voted to fund an arena backed by some of the leaders of the largest corporations in Charlotte. Who knows what that may mean now, but let's just, for the sake of argument, say these are really corporations and not elaborate shell games. I think the NHL, I think the NBA could do very well in putting a team. Although they are, let's be fair, moving a basketball team into a hockey hotbed now.
Yes, absolutely. But don't cities that lose teams usually have to wait a little while to get another one? I mean, usually it doesn't happen right away.
I think that the NBA is tacitly slapping Mr. Shin and Mr. Woolridge around here by saying, look, we know it was you guys. It wasn't the area. It wasn't the citizenry who kept voting down, you know, proposals to give you all this money to build your own arena so you'd have a lovely new building from which to thumb your nose at them. So the NBA is essentially saying to Charlotte, we love you, and essentially saying to Shin and Woolridge, we wish you'd go away, but stay in New Orleans where you belong.
Finally, Charlie, the Cup of Ill Cheer Award, which we haven't awarded in quite some time, goes this week to Nick Stamos, Director of Operations for Dickinson College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, for kicking 5 children out of the Washington Pro Football Team's practice because they were, gasp, selling drinks and chocolate chip cookies.
More to the point, they were selling drinks for half of what Mr. Stamos was charging inside the grounds. But one of them, we don't have to worry. The 11-year-old Sam Kohler said they're going to sell their drinks from a wagon that they can pull around the outside of the stadium. You'll never take me alive, copper.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and for Esquire magazine. He offers his opinions and occasionally lemonade each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
She is for cookie. That's good enough for me. That's good enough for me. That's good enough for me. That's good enough for me.
Of Karen Givens' story on freestyle frisbee, which ran in last week's program, Patricia Clancy, who hears us on WEVO in New Hampshire, wrote, "The story was a bit discouraging. It just shows again how Americans have to turn a game into a competition. Why do we do this? Why can't we just have fun?" Last week, Charlie Pierce commented on Lance Armstrong's performance in the ongoing Tour de France. Marcia Banks, who hears the program on KPBS in San Diego, was among several folks who were not pleased. Charlie should probably not comment on professional bicycling because he obviously does not know what he's talking about, Ms. Banks wrote. He said Lance Armstrong wasn't doing as well, and it will be more difficult for him to win this year. Lance has his eye on winning in Paris, and that means he can't try to win every stage of the tour. We got 2 letters suggesting stories we should do. Chris Marino, who hears the show on WHYY in Philadelphia, wrote, "Hey, great and fun show. It would be very cool, and you'd get a lot of listeners if you'd produce a segment on a drum and bugle corps. Part sport, part Broadway show, part concert." George Schuler, who listens to Vermont Public Radio, wants us to investigate a golf course up his way that was hacked out of the woods and features, quote, 5-foot-wide fairways and 5-foot greens. Sounded like something that would take an awfully good golfer. Sounds like a course that I would rather write about than play. Finally, a listener named Ernest Scott emailed to say, "I have a couple of comments to make. First, you never talk about college or amateur freestyle wrestling. Why not? Second, I sometimes find myself falling asleep in the middle of your show when you take on a mundane subject." Gee, I kind of hope Mr. Scott didn't hear the pro wrestling stuff this week and that he doesn't consider what comes next mundane. You can send us your comments by going to our website, onlyagame.org, and clicking on Contact. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. Our old-fashioned address is onlyagame, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a message on the listener line at 617-353-1860. Every once in a while, somebody emails Only a Game to tell me that we don't have enough stories about motorsports. Oh, yeah? Well, take this report from reporter Nick Roman of member station KLON in Los Angeles.
Here in the desert town of Rosamond, California, about 90 miles north of Los Angeles, is Willow Springs Raceway. Every few weeks, rich guys with Porsches and gorgeous blonde girlfriends tape up the headlights of their equally gorgeous sports cars and run a few laps on one of the Willow Springs tracks. But I'm not where the Porsches and the blonde girlfriends are. No, I'm over here, watching grown men racing little pot-pot motor scooters. At least it's still racing, right? I mean, a guy like Mike Vega, looking cool in a silver helmet, black boots, and fluorescent green leathers. A guy like this has to be into the speed and danger of racing.
The scooter part came first. I originally got a Vespa motor scooter because my mom wouldn't let me get a motorcycle out of high school. And I was able to talk her into a scooter being smaller and more manageable, and she went for that.
Okay, Mike Vega knows his scooter sounds and looks sort of, well, sissy.
They're mostly a novelty. You get a lot of looks when you're riding around on a scooter.
Well, what kind of looks? I mean, good looks, like
sometimes
admiring,
or
people going, what's this guy doing on this thing?
Sometimes you get good looks and thumbs up, and that's a cute bike. And sometimes you get people yelling at you to get a real bike or get a Harley or something like that. But you kind of get used to it.
Or maybe you don't. So you join up with the ASRA, the American Scooter Racing Association, a group of West Coast scooter owners who stage their own races at tracks in California and Las Vegas. The field numbers 30 or so, loan officers, shipping managers, all racing amateurs, but with a weird attraction to motor scooters.
The scooters do seem to be appealing to those who were of age to drive them 20 years ago but didn't have the opportunity for some reason or another, and now they have the means.
That's Fabio Ballerin. He sells new scooters at his Vespa Super Shop in San Diego, and he helps scooter racers get parts for their old Vespas and Lambrettas. They need them because virtually every racing scooter is as old or older than its scooter racer.
Giving a quick glance at the rest of the park of machines, I gotta say there's probably nothing newer than 20 years old.
That's not because scooter racers are a nostalgic bunch, although they are. It's because they want to win. In the early 70s, new smog rules forced scooter manufacturers to build bikes with smaller engines. Vince Chu, one of the top scooter racers this year and every year, says a smaller engine is a lot cleaner, but a lot slower.
The older bikes, you know, the 200cc's, are a lot more powerful than the new ones that are coming out. And plus, the new ones that's coming out are automatic. So we might have a separate class just for automatics. If someone really wants to spend $3,900 on a brand new ET4 and take it out on the track, I think that's kind of crazy, though. Go with an older bike and an older stock bike. It's a lot cheaper that way.
And Vince Chu should know. A few years back, he was racing one of his bikes.
I lost the front wheel, I think, and I flew backwards. And in slow motion, I saw the bike just disintegrate in front of me. And didn't get hurt, though, just minor bruises.
When you saw that bike in slow motion, were you thinking, oh, I might be hurt, or were you thinking, there goes $1,000?
Actually, I wasn't thinking about myself. I wasn't thinking about the money situation. I was just thinking, oh, how am I supposed to race next race? I was just looking at my bike, like my handlebar break. I'm like, oh, man. But that's racing, you know.
On this Saturday at Willow Springs, the scooter racers had to share the track with a bigger field of young gun motorcycle racers. Well, the motorcycles took off first, and when they got halfway around the track, the scooters got the green flag. After a few laps, the fastest scooter, running at 90 miles an hour on the straightaways, caught and passed the motorcycles at the tail end. That kind of speed drew Joe Kokish of St. Louis to scooter racing.
Just liking to make my scooter go fast, and this way I can do it without getting tickets.
Yeah, that's an important consideration.
Exactly.
Have you gotten tickets on it?
Yes, I have. A couple. Speeding.
What did it cost you?
I don't even remember. It's been a couple years ago. I've gotten smarter at looking for police.
Joe Kokish also set up his own scooter racing circuit in the Midwest, Mid-American Scooter Sports. He's got a scooter racing event in Norway, Illinois, on August 31st. The next time the American Scooter Racing Association runs at Willow Springs is mid-October. The Porsche owners will be there, too. But I'll hang out with the scooters. Well, okay, maybe I'll check the pits to see if the Porsche guys have any new girlfriends. For Only a Game, I'm Nick Roman in Rosamond, California.
Runner number one, Vince Chews, out of Las Vegas, Nevada. Number 31, Pat Lonnie.
Go!
Sports at Toy Shop. Number 7, Pat.
I'm gonna wake you up early, cause I'm gonna take a ride with you. We're going down to the Honda shop, I'll tell you what we're gonna do. Put on a ragged sweatshirt, I'll take you anywhere you want me to.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Tad Curry. We had help this week from Mike Garth, Glenn Alexander, Keith Infantino, and John Guardo at NPR's New York Bureau. Our senior producer is Gary Wallen. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again, witness the mania in evidence before our recent WWE SmackDown, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Sex, Lies, and Headlocks author Shauna Sale, who didn't believe me when I said I had never watched pro wrestling.
Oh, come on, Bill, admit it. In college, you came close.
Well, yeah, I... Hey, how did he know about that night? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Hang on tight. I better turn on the lights so we can ride my Honda tonight.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, educating discerning patients and dentists since 1985 about their options for the replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR. Wake up. This is WBUR. Wake up.